which she had with him the first evening in Mr. Bell's presence, she had had no great intercourse with him, further than that which arose out of their close relations with the same household. But this was enough to wear off the shyness on her side and any symptoms of mortified pride and vanity on his. They met continually, of course, but she thought that he rather avoided being alone with her. She fancied that he, as well as she, perceived that they had drifted strangely apart from their former anchorage, side by side, in many of their opinions and all their tastes. And yet, when he had spoken unusually well, or with remarkable epigrammatic point, she felt that his eyes sought the expression of her countenance first of all, if but for an instant, and that, in the family intercourse which constantly threw them together, her opinion was the one to which he listened with a deference, the more complete because it was reluctantly paid and concealed as much as possible. Chapter 48. Ne'er to be found again. My own, my father's friend, I cannot part with thee. I ne'er have shown, thou ne'er hast known, how dear thou art to me. Anon. The elements of the dinner parties which Mrs. Lennox gave were these. Her friends contributed the beauty, Captain Lennox the easy knowledge of the subjects of the day, and Mr. Henry Lennox and the sprinkling of rising men who were received as his friends brought the wit, the cleverness, the keen and extensive knowledge of which they knew well enough how to avail themselves without seeming pedantic or burdening the rapid flow of conversation. These dinners were delightful, but even here Margaret's dissatisfaction found her out. Every talent, every feeling, every acquirement, nay, even every tendency towards virtue, was used up as materials for fireworks. The hidden, sacred fire exhausted itself in sparkle and crackle. They talked about art in a merely sensuous way, dwelling on outside effects, instead of allowing themselves to learn what it has to teach. They lashed themselves up into an enthusiasm about high subjects in company and never thought about them when they were alone. They squandered their capabilities of appreciation into a mere flow of appropriate words. One day, after the gentleman had come up into the drawing-room, Mr. Lennox drew near to Margaret and addressed her in almost the first voluntary words he had spoken to her since she had returned to live in Harley Street. "You did not look pleased at what Shirley was saying at dinner." "Didn't I? My face must be very expressive," replied Margaret. "It always was. It has not lost the trick of being eloquent." "I did not like," said Margaret hastily, "his way of advocating what he knew to be wrong, so glaringly wrong, even in jest." "But it was very clever, how every word told. Do you remember the happy epithets?"
"Yes."
"And despise them, you would like to add. Pray don't scruple, though he is my friend."
"There, that is the exact tone in you that—"
She stopped short.
He listened for a moment to see if she would finish her sentence, but she only reddened and turned away. Before she did so, however, she heard him say in a very low, clear voice,
"If my tones or modes of thought are what you dislike, will you do me the justice to tell me so, and so give me the chance of learning to please you?" All these weeks there was no intelligence of Mr. Bell's going to Milton. He had spoken of it at Helston as a journey which he might have to take in a very short time from then. But he must have transacted his business by writing, Margaret thought, ere now, and she knew that if he could, he would avoid going to a place which he disliked, and moreover would little understand the secret importance which she affixed to the explanation that could only be given by word of mouth. She knew that he would feel that it was necessary that it should be done, but whether in summer, autumn or winter, it would signify very little. It was now August, and there had been no mention of the Spanish journey to which he had alluded to Edith, and Margaret tried to reconcile herself to the fading away of this illusion. But one morning she received a letter, saying that next week he meant to come up to town. He wanted to see her about a plan which he had in his head, and, moreover, he intended to treat himself to a little doctoring, as he had begun to come round to her opinion,
but it would be pleasanter to think that his health was more in fault than he, when he found himself irritable and cross. There was altogether a tone of forced cheerfulness in the letter, as Margaret noticed afterwards, but at the time her attention was taken up by Edith's exclamations.
"Coming up to town? Oh, dear, and I am so worn out by the heat that I don't believe I have strength enough in me for another dinner. Besides, everybody has left but our dear stupid selves, who can't settle where to go. There would be nobody to meet him. I'm sure he would much rather come and dine with us quite alone than with the most agreeable strangers you could pick up. Besides, if he is not well, he won't wish for invitations. I am glad he has owned it at last. I was sure he was ill from the whole tone of his letters, and yet he would not answer me when I asked him, and I had no third person to whom I could apply for news.
Oh, he is not very ill, or he would not think of Spain.
He never mentions Spain.
No, but his plan that is to be proposed evidently relates to that. But would you really go in such weather as this?
Oh, it will get cooler every day.
Yes, think of it.
I am only afraid I have thought and wished too much, in that absorbing, willful way which is sure to be disappointed, or else gratified to the letter, while in the spirit it gives no pleasure.
But that's superstitious, I'm sure, Margaret.
No, I don't think it is. Only it ought to warn me, and check me from giving way to such passionate wishes. It is a sort of give me children or else I die. I'm afraid my cry is, let me go to Cadiz or else I die.
My dear Margaret, you'll be persuaded to stay there, and then what shall I do? Oh, I wish I could find somebody for you to marry here, but I could be sure of you.
I shall never marry.
Nonsense and double nonsense. Why, as Sholto says, you're such an attraction to the house, but he knows ever so many men who will be glad to visit here next year for your sake.
Margaret drew herself up haughtily. Do you know, Edith, I sometimes think your Corfu life has taught you,
well, just a shade or two of coarseness.
Edith began to sob bitterly, and to declare so vehemently that Margaret had lost all love for her and no longer looked upon her as a friend, that Margaret came to think that she had expressed too harsh an opinion for the relief of her own wounded pride, and ended by being Edith's slave for the rest of the day. While that little lady, overcome by wounded feeling, lay like a victim on the sofa, having occasionally a profound sigh till at last she fell asleep. Mr. Bell did not make his appearance even on the day to which he had, for a second time, deferred his visit. The next morning there came a letter from Wallace, his servant, stating that his master had not been feeling well for some time, which had been the true reason for his putting off his journey, and that at the very time when he should have set out for London, he had been seized with an apoplectic fit. It was indeed, Wallace added, the opinion of the medical men, that he could not survive the night, and more than probable that by the time Miss Hale received this letter, his poor master would be no more. Margaret received this letter at breakfast time, and turned very pale as she read it. Then silently putting it into Edith's hands, she left the room. Edith was terribly shocked as she read it, and cried in a sobbing, frightened, childish way, much to her husband's distress. Mrs. Shaw was breakfasting in her own room, and upon him devolved the task of reconciling his wife to the near contact into which she seemed to be brought with death, for the first time that she could remember in her life. Here was a man who was to have dined with them today, lying dead or dying instead. It was some time before she could think of Margaret. Then she started up and followed her upstairs into her room. Dixon was packing up a few toilette articles, and Margaret was hastily putting on her bonnet, shedding tears all the time, and her hands trembling so that she could hardly tie the strings.
"Oh, dear Margaret, how shocking! What are you doing? Are you going out? Sholto would telegraph or do anything you like."
"I am going to Oxford. There is a train in half an hour. Dixon has offered to go with me, but I could have gone by myself. I must see him again. Besides, he may be better and want some care. He has been like a father to me. Don't stop me, Edith."
"But I must. Mama won't like it at all. Come and ask her about it, Margaret.
You don't know where you're going. I should not mind if he had a house of his own, but in his fellow's rooms? Come to Mama, and do ask her before you go. It will not take a minute."
Margaret yielded and lost her train. In the suddenness of the event, Mrs. Shaw became bewildered and hysterical, and so the precious time slipped by. But there was another train in a couple of hours, and after various discussions on propriety and impropriety, it was decided that Captain Lennox should accompany Margaret, as the one thing to which she was constant was her resolution to go, alone or otherwise, by the next train, whatever might be said of the propriety or impropriety of the step. Her father's friend, her own friend, was lying at the point of death, and the thought of this came upon her with such vividness that she was surprised herself at the firmness with which she asserted something of her right to independence of action. And 5 minutes before the time for starting, she found herself sitting in a railway carriage opposite to Captain Lennox. It was always a comfort to her to think that she had gone, though it was only to hear that he had died in the night. She saw the rooms that he had occupied, and associated them ever after most fondly in her memory with the idea of her father and his one cherished and faithful friend. They had promised Edith before starting that if all had ended as they feared, they would return to dinner, so that long lingering look around the room in which her father had died had to be interrupted, and a quiet farewell taken of the kind old face that had so often come out with pleasant words and merry quips and cranks. Captain Lennox fell asleep on their journey home, and Margaret could cry at leisure, and bethink her of this fatal year and all the woes it had brought to her. No sooner was she fully aware of one loss than another came, not to supersede her grief for the one before, but to reopen wounds and feelings scarcely healed. But at the sound of the tender voices of her aunt and Edith, of merry little Sholto's glee at her arrival, and at the sight of the well-lighted rooms, with their mistress pretty in her paleness and her eager, sorrowful interest, Margaret roused herself from her heavy trance of almost superstitious hopelessness, and began to feel that even around her joy and gladness might gather. She had Edith's place on the sofa. Sholto was taught to carry Aunt Margaret's cup of tea very carefully to her, and by the time she went up to dress, she could thank God for having spared her dear old friend a long or a painful illness. But when night came, solemn night, and all the house was quiet, Margaret still sate watching the beauty of a London sky at such an hour, on such a summer evening. The faint pink reflection of earthly lights on the soft clouds that float tranquilly into the white moonlight, out of the warm gloom which lies motionless around the horizon. Margaret's room had been the day nursery of her childhood, just when it merged into girlhood, and when the feelings and conscience had first been awakened into full activity. On some such night as this, she remembered promising to herself to live as brave and noble a life as any heroine she had ever read or heard of in romance, a life sans peur et sans reproche. It seemed to her then that she had only to will, and such a life would be accomplished. And now she had learnt that not only to will, but also to pray, was a necessary condition in the truly heroic. Trusting to herself, she had fallen. It was a just consequence of her sin that all excuses for it, all temptation to it, should remain for ever unknown to the person in whose opinion it had sunk her lowest. She stood face to face at last with her sin. She knew it for what it was. Mr. Bell's kindly sophistry that nearly all men were guilty of equivocal actions, and that the motive ennobled the evil, had never had much real weight with her. Her own first thought of how, if she had known at all, she might have fearlessly told the truth, seemed low and poor. Nay, even now, her anxiety to have her character for truth partially excused in Mr. Thornton's eyes, as Mr. Bell had promised to do, was a very small and petty consideration, now that she was afresh taught by death what life should be. If all the world spoke, acted, or kept silence with intent to deceive, if dearest interests were at stake and dearest lives in peril, If no one should ever know of her truth or her falsehood, to measure out their honour or contempt for her by, straight alone where she stood, in the presence of God, she prayed that she might have strength to speak and act the truth forevermore. Chapter 49. Breathing Tranquility. And down the sunny beach she paces slowly, with many doubtful pauses by the way. Grief hath an influence so hushed and holy. Hood.
"Is not Margaret the heiress?" whispered Edith to her husband, as they were in their room alone at night after the sad journey to Oxford.
She had pulled his tall head down and stood upon tiptoe and implored him not to be shocked before she had ventured to ask this question. Captain Lennox was, however, quite in the dark. If he had ever heard, he had forgotten. It could not be much that a fellow of a small college had to leave. But he had never wanted her to pay for her board, and £250 a year was something ridiculous, considering that she did not take wine. Edith came down upon her feet a little sadder, with her romance blown to pieces. A week afterwards, she came prancing towards her husband and made him a low curtsy.
"I am right, and you are wrong, most noble captain. Margaret has had a lawyer's letter, and she is residuary legatee. The legacies being about £2,000, and the remainder about £40,000, at the present value of property in Milton."
"Indeed. And how does she take her good fortune?"
"Oh, it seems she knew she was to have it all along, only she had no idea it was so much. She looks very white and pale, and says she's afraid of it. But that's nonsense, you know, and will soon go off. I left Mama pouring congratulations down her throat, and stole away to tell you."
It seemed to be supposed, by general consent, that the most natural thing was to consider Mr. Lennox henceforward as Margaret's legal adviser. She was so entirely ignorant of all forms of business that in nearly everything she had to refer to him. He chose out her attorney. He came to her with papers to be signed. He was never so happy as when teaching her of what all these mysteries of the law were the signs and types.
"Henry," said Edith one day archly, "do you know what I hope and expect all these long conversations with Margaret will end in?"
"No, I don't," said he, reddening, "and I desire you not to tell me."
"Oh, very well. Then I need not tell Sholto not to ask Mr. Montague so often to the house."
"Just as you choose," said he with forced coolness. "What you are thinking of may or may not happen. But this time, before I commit myself, I will see my ground clear. Ask whom you choose. It may not be very civil, Edith, but if you meddle in it, you will mar it. She has been very farouche with me for a long time, and is only just beginning to thaw a little from her Zenobia ways. She has the making of a Cleopatra in her, if only she were a little more pagan."
"For my part," said Edith a little maliciously, "I am very glad she is a Christian. I know so very few."
There was no Spain for Margaret that autumn, although to the last she hoped that some fortunate occasion would call Frederick to Paris, whither she could easily have met with a convoy. Instead of Cadiz, she had to content herself with Cromer. To that place her Aunt Shaw and the Lennoxes were bound. They had all along wished her to accompany them, and consequently, with their characters, they made but lazy efforts to forward her own separate wish. Perhaps Cromer was, in one sense of the expression, the best for her. She needed bodily strengthening and bracing as well as rest. Among other hopes that had vanished was the hope, the trust that she had had, that Mr. Bell would have given Mr. Thornton the simple facts of the family circumstances which had preceded the unfortunate accident that led to Leonard's death. Whatever opinion, however changed it might be from what Mr. Thornton had once entertained, she had wished it to be based upon a true understanding of what she had done, and why she had done it. It would have been a pleasure to her, would have given her rest on a point on which she should now all her life be restless, unless she could resolve not to think upon it. It was now so long after the time of these occurrences that there was no possible way of explaining them, save the one which she had lost by Mr. Bell's death. she must just submit, like many another, to be misunderstood. But though reasoning herself into the belief that in this hers was no uncommon lot, her heart did not ache the less with longing that some time, years and years hence, before he died at any rate, he might know how much she had been tempted. She thought that she did not want to hear that all was explained to him, if only she could be sure that he would know. But this wish was vain, like so many others, and when she had schooled herself into this conviction, she turned with all her heart and strength to the life that lay immediately before her, and resolved to strive to make the best of that. She used to sit long hours upon the beach, gazing intently on the waves as they chafed with perpetual motion against the pebbly shore, or she looked out upon the more distant heave and sparkle against the sky, and heard, without being conscious of hearing, the eternal psalm, which went up continually. She was soothed without knowing how or why. Listlessly she sat there, on the ground, her hands clasped round her knees, while her Aunt Shaw did small shoppings, and Edith and Captain Lennox rode far and wide on shore and inland. The nurses, sauntering on with their charges, would pass and repass her, and wonder in whispers what she could find to look at so long, day after day. And when the family gathered at dinner-time, Margaret was so silent and absorbed that Edith voted her moped, and held a proposal of her husband's with great satisfaction that Mr. Henry Lennox should be asked to take Cromer for a week on his return from Scotland in October. But all this time, for thought enabled Margaret to put events in their right places as to origin and significance, both as regarded her past life and her future. Those hours by the seaside were not lost, as anyone might have seen who had the perception to read or the care to understand the look that Margaret's face was gradually acquiring. Mr. Henry Lennox was excessively struck by the change. "The sea has done Miss Hale an immense deal of good, I should fancy," said he, when she first left the room after his arrival in their family circle. "She looks 10 years younger than she did in Harley Street."
"That's the bonnet I got her," said Edith triumphantly. "I knew it would suit her the moment I saw it."
"I beg your pardon," said Mr. Lennox, in the half-contemptuous, half-indulgent tone he generally used to Edith, "but I believe I know the difference between the charms of a dress and the charms of a woman. No mere bonnet would have made Miss Hale's eyes so lustrous and yet so soft, or her lips so ripe and red, and her face altogether so full of peace and light. She is like, and yet more," he dropped his voice, "like the Margaret Hale of Helston." From this time the clever and ambitious man bent all his powers to gaining Margaret. He loved her sweet beauty. He saw the latent sweep of her mind, which could easily, he thought, be led to embrace all the objects on which he had set his heart. He looked upon her fortune only as a part of the complete and superb character of herself and her position. Yet he was fully aware of the rise which it would immediately enable him, the poor barrister, to take. Eventually he would earn such success and such honours as would enable him to pay her back, with interest, that first advance in wealth which he should owe to her. He had been to Milton on business connected with her property on his return from Scotland, and with the quick eye of a skilled lawyer, ready ever to take in and weigh contingencies, he had seen that much additional value was yearly accruing to the lands and tenements which she owned in that prosperous and increasing town. He was glad to find that the present relationship between Margaret and himself, of client and legal adviser, was gradually superseding the recollection of that unlucky, mismanaged day at Helston. He had thus unusual opportunities of intimate intercourse with her, besides those that arose from the connection between the families. Margaret was only too willing to listen as long as he talked of Milton, though he had seen none of the people whom she more especially knew. It had been the tone with her aunt and cousin to speak of Milton with dislike and contempt. Just such feelings as Margaret was ashamed to remember she had expressed and felt on first going to live there. But Mr. Lennox almost exceeded Margaret in his appreciation of the character of Milton and its inhabitants. Their energy, their power, their indomitable courage in struggling and fighting, their lurid vividness of existence captivated and arrested his attention. He was never tired of talking about them, and had never perceived how selfish and material were too many of the ends they proposed to themselves as the result of all their mighty, untiring endeavour, till Margaret, even in the midst of her gratification, had the candour to point this out as the tainting sin in so much that was noble and to be admired. Still, when other subjects palled upon her, and she gave but short answers to many questions, Henry Lennox found out but an inquiry as to some Darkshire peculiarity of character called back the light into her eye, the glow into her cheek. When they returned to town, Margaret fulfilled one of her seaside resolves and took her life into her own hands. Before they went to Cromer, she had been as docile to her aunt's laws as if she were still the scared little stranger who cried herself to sleep that first night in the Harley Street nursery. But she had learned, in those solemn hours of thought, that she herself must one day answer for her own life and what she had done with it. And she tried to settle that most difficult problem for women. How much was to be utterly merged into obedience to authority, and how much might be set apart for freedom in working? Mrs. Shaw was as good-tempered as could be, and Edith had inherited this charming domestic quality. Margaret herself had probably the worst temper of the three, for her quick perceptions and over-lively imagination made her hasty, and her early isolation from sympathy had made her proud. But she had an indescribable childlike sweetness of heart, which made her manners, even in her rarely wilful moods, irresistible of old. And now, chastened even by what the world called her good fortune, she charmed her reluctant aunt into acquiescence with her will. So Margaret gained the acknowledgement of her right to follow her own ideas of duty.
"Only don't be strong-minded," pleaded Edith. "Mamma wants you to have a footman of your own, and I'm sure you're very welcome, for they're great plagues. Only to please me, darling, don't go and have a strong mind. It's the only thing I ask. Footman or no footman, don't be strong-minded."
"Don't be afraid, Edith. I'll faint on your hands at the servants' dinner-time, the very first opportunity. And then, what with Sholto playing with the fire and the baby crying, you'll begin to wish for a strong-minded woman equal to any emergency."
"And you'll not grow too good to joke and be merry?"
"Not I. I shall be merrier than I have ever been, now that I have got my own way."
"And you'll not go a figure, but let me buy your dresses for you?"
"Indeed, I mean to buy them for myself. You shall come with me if you like, but no one can please me but myself."
"Oh, I was afraid you'd dress in brown and dust colour, not to show the dirt you'll pick up in all those places. I'm glad you're going to keep one or two vanities, just by way of specimens of the old Adam."
"I'm going to be just the same, Edith, if you and my aunt could but fancy so. Only as I have neither husband nor child to give me natural duties, I must make myself some, in addition to ordering my gowns." In the family conclave, which was made up of Edith, her mother, and her husband, it was decided that perhaps all these plans of hers would only secure her the more for Henry Lennox. They kept her out of the way of other friends who might have eligible sons or brothers, and it was also agreed that she never seemed to take much pleasure in the society of anyone but Henry, out of their own family. The other admirers, attracted by her appearance or the reputation of her fortune, were swept away by her unconscious smiling disdain into the parts frequented by other beauties less fastidious, or other heiresses with a larger amount of gold. Henry and she grew slowly into closer intimacy, but neither he nor she were people to brook the slightest notice of their proceedings. Chapter 50. Changes at Milton. "Here we go, up, 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 and here we go, down, down, downy." Nursery song. Meanwhile at Milton, the chimneys smoked, The ceaseless roar and mighty beat and dizzying whirl of machinery struggled and strove perpetually. Senseless and purposeless were wood and iron and steam in their endless labours. But the persistence of their monotonous work was rivaled in tireless endurance by the strong crowds, who with sense and with purpose were busy and restless in seeking after what? In the streets there were few loiterers, none walking for mere pleasure. Every man's face was set in lines of eagerness or anxiety. News was sought for with fierce avidity, and men jostled each other aside in the mart and in the exchange, as they did in life, in the deep selfishness of competition. There was gloom over the town. Few came to buy, and those who did were looked at suspiciously by the sellers, for credit was insecure, and the most stable might have their fortunes affected by the sweep in the great neighbouring port among the shipping houses. Hitherto there had been no failures in Milton, but from the immense speculations that had come to light in making a bad end in America and yet nearer home, it was known that some Milton houses of business must suffer so severely that every day men's faces asked, if their tongues did not, "What news? Who is gone? How will it affect me?" And if two or three spoke together, they dwelt rather on the names of those who were safe than dared to hint at those likely, in their opinion, to go. For idle breath may, at such times, cause the downfall of some who might otherwise weather the storm, and one going down drags many after. "Thornton is safe," say they. "His business is large, extending every year, but such a head as he has, and so prudent with all his daring." Then one man draws another aside and walks a little apart, and with head inclined into his neighbour's ear, he says, "Thornton's business is large, but he has spent his profits in extending it. He has no capital laid by. His machinery is new within these 2 years, and has cost him, we won't say what, a word to the wise." But that Mr. Harrison was a croaker, a man who had succeeded to his father's trade-made fortune, which he had feared to lose by altering his mode of business to any having a larger scope, yet he grudged every penny made by others more daring and far-sighted. But the truth was, Mr. Thornton was hard-pressed. He felt it acutely in his vulnerable point, his pride in the commercial character which he had established for himself. Architect of his own fortunes, he attributed this to no special merit or qualities of his own, but to the power which he believed that commerce gave to every brave, honest, and persevering man to raise himself to a level from which he might see and read the great game of worthy success, and honestly, by such far-sightedness, command more power and influence than in any other mode of life. Far away in the east and in the west, where his person would never be known, his name was to be regarded, and his wishes to be fulfilled, and his word pass like gold. That was the idea of merchant life with which Mr. Thornton had started. "Her merchants be like princes," said his mother, reading the text aloud, as if it were a trumpet call to invite her boy to the struggle. He was, but like many others, men, women, and children, alive to distant and dead to near things. He sought to possess the influence of a name in foreign countries and faraway seas, to become the head of a firm that should be known for generations, and it had taken him long silent years to come even to a glimmering of what he might be now, today, here in his own town, his own factory, among his own people. He and they had led parallel lives, very close but never touching, till the accident, or so it seemed, of his acquaintance with Higgins. Once brought face to face, man to man, with an individual of the masses around him, and take notice out of the character of master and workman, in the first instance they had each begun to recognize that we have all of us one human heart. It was the fine point of the wedge, and until now, when the apprehension of losing his connection with two or three of the workmen, whom he had so lately begun to know as men, of having a plan or two, which were experiments lying very close to his heart, roughly nipped off without trial, gave a new poignancy to the subtle fear that came over him from time to time. Until now, he had never recognized how much and how deep was the interest he had grown of late to feel in his position as manufacturer, simply because it led him into such close contact and gave him the opportunity of so much power among a race of people strange, shrewd, ignorant, but above all full of character and strong human feeling. He reviewed his position as a Milton manufacturer. The strike of a year and a half ago, or more, for it was now untimely wintry weather in a late spring, that strike when he was young and he now was old, had prevented his completing some of the large orders he had then on hand. He had locked up a good deal of his capital in new and expensive machinery, and he had also bought cotton largely for the fulfillment of these orders taken under contract. That he had not been able to complete them was owing in some degree to the utter want of skill on the part of the Irish hands whom he had imported. Much of their work was damaged and unfit to be sent forth by a house which prided itself on turning out nothing but first-rate articles. For many months, the embarrassment caused by the strike had been an obstacle in Mr. Thornton's way. And often, when his eyes fell on Higgins, he could have spoken angrily to him without any present cause, just from feeling how serious was the injury that had arisen from this affair in which he was implicated. But when he became conscious of this sudden, quick resentment, he resolved to curb it. It would not satisfy him to avoid Higgins. He must convince himself that he was master over his own anger by being particularly careful to allow Higgins access to him whenever the strict rules of business, or Mr. Thornton's leisure, permitted. And by, he lost all sense of resentment in wonder how it was, or could be, that two men like himself and Higgins, living by the same trade, working in their different ways at the same object, could look upon each other's position and duties in so strangely different a way. And thence arose that intercourse, which though it might not have the effect of preventing all future clash of opinion and action, when the occasion arose, would at any rate enable both master and man to look upon each other with far more charity and sympathy, and bear with each other more patiently and kindly. Besides this improvement of feeling, both Mr. Thornton and his workmen found out their ignorance as to positive matters of fact, known heretofore to one side but not to the other. But now had come one of those periods of bad trade, when the market falling brought down the value of all large stocks. Mr. Thornton's fell to nearly half. No orders were coming in, so he lost the interest of the capital he had locked up in machinery. Indeed, it was difficult to get payment for the orders completed. Yet there was the constant drain of expenses for working the business. Then the bills came due for the cotton he had purchased, and money being scarce, he could only borrow at exorbitant interest, and yet he could not realize any of his property. But he did not despair. He exerted himself day and night to foresee and to provide for all emergencies. He was as calm and gentle to the women in his home as ever. To the workmen in his mill, he spoke not many words, but they knew him by this time, and many a curt, decided answer was received by them rather with sympathy for the care they saw pressing upon him than with the suppressed antagonism which had formerly been smouldering and ready for hard words and hard judgments on all occasions. "The meester's a deal to potter him," said Higgins one day, as he heard Mr. Thornton's short, sharp inquiry why such a command had not been obeyed, and caught the sound of the suppressed sigh which he heaved in going past the room where some of the men were working. Higgins and another man stopped over hours that night, unknown to anyone, to get the neglected piece of work done. And Mr. Thornton never knew but that the overlooker, to whom he had given the command in the first instance, had done it himself. "Eh, I reckon I know who have been sorry for to see our maester sitting so like a piece of grey calico. The old parson would have fretted his woman's heart out if he'd seen the woeful looks I have seen on our maester's face," thought Higgins one day, as he was approaching Mr. Thornton in Marlborough Street. "Maester," he said, stopping his employer in his quick, resolved walk and causing that gentleman to look up with a sudden annoyed start, as if his thoughts had been far away. "Have you heard out of Miss Margaret lately?" "Miss who?"
replied Mr. Thornton. Miss Margaret, Miss Hale, the old parson's daughter. You know who I mean well enough, if you'll only think a bit. There was nothing disrespectful in the tone in which this was said. Oh, yes. And suddenly the wintry, frost-bound look of care had left Mr. Thornton's face, as if some soft summer gale had blown all anxiety away from his mind. And though his mouth was as much compressed as before, his eyes smiled out benignly on his questioner. "She's my landlord now, you know, Higgins. I hear of her through her agent here every now and then. She's well and among friends. Thank you, Higgins." That "thank you," that lingered after the other words, and yet came with so much warmth of feeling, let in a new light to the acute Higgins. It might be but a will-o'-the-wisp, but he thought he would follow it and ascertain whither it would lead him. "And she's not getting married, meester?" "Not yet." The face was cloudy once more. "There is some talk of it, as I understand, with a connection of the family." "Then she'll not be coming to Milton again, I reckon." "No." "Stop a minute, meester." Then going up confidentially close, he said, "Is the young gentleman cleared?" He enforced the depth of his intelligence by a wink of the eye, which only made things more mysterious to Mr. Thornton. "The young gentleman, I mean, Master Frederick, they called him. Her brother as was over here, you known." "Over here?" "Aye, to be sure, at the missus's death. You need now be feared of my telling, for Mary and me, we knowed it all along, only we held our peace, for we got it through Mary working in the house." "And he was over? It was her brother?" "Sure enough, and I reckon you knowed it, or I'd never ha' let on. You knowed she had a brother?" "Yes, I know all about him, and he was over at Mrs. Hale's death." "Nay, I'm not going for to tell more. I've maybe getting them into mischief already, for they kept it very close. I nobbut wanted to know if they'd gotten him cleared." "Not that I know of. I know nothing. I only hear of Miss Hale now, as my landlord, and through her lawyer." He broke off from Higgins to follow the business on which he had been bent when the latter first accosted him, leaving Higgins baffled in his endeavour. "It was her brother," said Mr. Thornton to himself. "I am glad. I may never see her again, but it is a comfort, a relief, to know that much. I knew she could not be unmaidenly, and yet I yearned for conviction. Now I am glad." It was a little golden thread running through the dark web of his present fortunes, which were growing ever gloomier and more gloomy. His agent had largely trusted a house in the American trade, which went down along with several others, just at this time, like a pack of cards, the fall of one compelling other failures. What were Mr. Thornton's engagements? Could he stand? Night after night he took books and papers into his own private room, and sate up there long after the family were gone to bed. He thought that no one knew of this occupation, of the hours he should have spent in sleep. One morning, when daylight was stealing in through the crevices of his shutters, and he had never been in bed, and in hopeless indifference of mind, was thinking that he could do without the hour or two of rest, which was all that he should be able to take before the stir of daily labour began again, the door of his room opened, and his mother stood there, dressed as she had been the day before. She had never laid herself down to slumber any more than he. Their eyes met. Their faces were cold and rigid and wan from long watching. "Mother, why are you not in bed?" "Son John," said she, "do you think I can sleep with an easy mind while you keep awake full of care? You have not told me what your trouble is, but sore trouble you have had these many days past."
"Trade is bad."
"And you dread?"
"I dread nothing," replied he, drawing up his head and holding it erect. "I know now that no man will suffer by me. That was my anxiety."
"But how do you stand? Shall you... will it be a failure?" Her steady voice trembling in an unwonted manner.
"Not a failure. I must give up business, but I pay all men. I might redeem myself. I am sorely tempted."
"How? Oh, John, keep up your name. Try all risks for that. How redeem it?"
"By a speculation offered to me, full of risk, but if successful, placing me high above watermark. so that no one need ever know the strait I am in. Still, if it fails...
And if it fails, said she, advancing and laying her hand on his arm, her eyes full of eager light, she held her breath to hear the end of his speech.
Honest men are ruined by a rogue, said he gloomily. As I stand now, my creditors' money is safe, every farthing of it, but I don't know where to find my own. It may all be gone, and I penniless at this moment. Therefore, it is my creditors' money that I should risk.
But if it succeeded, they need never know. Is it so desperate a speculation? I'm sure it is not, or you would never have thought of it. If it succeeded,
I should be a rich man, and my peace of conscience would be gone.
Why, you would have injured no one.
No, but I should have run the risk of ruining many for my own paltry aggrandizement. Mother, I have decided. You won't much grieve over our leaving this house, shall you, dear mother?
No, but to have you other than what you are will break my heart. What can you do?
Be always the same John Thornton in whatever circumstances, endeavouring to do right and making great blunders, and then trying to be brave in setting to afresh. But it is hard, mother. I have so worked and planned. I have discovered new powers in my situation too late, and now all is over. I am too old to begin again with the same heart. It is hard, mother. He turned away from her and covered his face with his hands.
I can't think, said she, with gloomy defiance in her tone, how it comes about. Here is my boy, good son, just man, tender heart, and he fails in all he sets his mind upon. He finds a woman to love, and she cares no more for his affection than if he had been any common man. He labours, and his labour comes to naught. Other people prosper and grow rich, and hold their paltry names high and dry above shame.
Shame never touched me, said he in a low tone, but she went on.
I sometimes have wondered where justice was gone to, and now I don't believe there is such a thing in the world. Now you are come to this. You, my own John Thornton, though you and I may be beggars together, my own dear son...
She fell upon his neck and kissed him through her tears.
Mother, said he, holding her gently in his arms, who has sent me my lot in life, both of good and of evil?
She shook her head. She would have nothing to do with religion just then.
Mother, he went on, seeing that she would not speak, I too have been rebellious, but I am striving to be so no longer. Help me, as you helped me when I was a child. Then you said many good words. When my father died, and we were sometimes sorely short of comforts, which we shall never be now, you said brave, noble, trustful words then, mother, which I have never forgotten, though they may have lain dormant. Speak to me again in the old way, mother. Do not let us have to think that the world has too much hardened our hearts. If you would say the old good words, it would make me feel something of the pious simplicity of my childhood. I say them to myself, but they would come differently from you, remembering all the cares and trials you have had to bear.
I have had many, said she, sobbing, but none so sore as this, to see you cast down from your rightful place.
I could say it for myself, John, but not for you, not for you. God has seen fit to be very hard on you, very.
She shook with the sobs that come so convulsively when an old person weeps. The silence around her struck her at last, and she quieted herself to listen. No sound. She looked. Her son sat by the table, his arms thrown half across it, his head bent face downwards.
Oh, John,
she said, and she lifted his face up. Such a strange pallid look of gloom was on it that for a moment it struck her that this look was the forerunner of death. But as the rigidity melted out of the countenance and the natural colour returned, and she saw that he was himself once again, all worldly mortification sank to nothing before the consciousness of the great blessing that he himself, by his simple existence, was to her. She thanked God for this, and this alone, with a fervour that swept away all rebellious feelings from her mind. He did not speak readily, but he went and opened the shutters and let the ruddy light of dawn flood the room. But the wind was in the east. The weather was piercing cold, as it had been for weeks. There would be no demand for light summer goods this year. That hope for the revival of trade must utterly be given up. It was a great comfort to have had this conversation with his mother, and to feel sure that however they might henceforward keep silence on all these anxieties, they yet understood each other's feelings, and were, if not in harmony, at least not in discord with each other in their way of viewing them. Fanny's husband was vexed at Thornton's refusal to take any share in the speculation which he had offered to him, and withdrew from any possibility of being supposed able to assist him with the ready money, which indeed the speculator needed for his own venture. There was nothing for it at last but that which Mr. Thornton had dreaded for many weeks. He had to give up the business in which he had been so long engaged with so much honour and success, and look out for a subordinate situation. Marlborough Mills and the adjacent dwelling were held under a long lease. They must, if possible, be re-let. There was an immediate choice of situations offered to Mr. Thornton. Mr. Hamper would have been only too glad to have secured him as a steady and experienced partner for his son, whom he was setting up with a large capital in a neighbouring town. But the young man was half-educated as regarded information, and wholly uneducated as regarded any other responsibility than that of getting money, and brutalized both as to his pleasures and his pains. Mr. Thornton declined having any share in a partnership which would frustrate what few plans he had that survived the wreck of his fortunes. He would sooner consent to be only a manager, where he could have a certain degree of power beyond the mere money-getting part, than have to fall in with the tyrannical humours of a moneyed partner with whom he felt sure that he should quarrel in a few months. So he waited, and stood on one side with profound humility as the news swept through the exchange of the enormous fortune which his brother-in-law had made by his daring speculation. It was a 9 days' wonder. Success brought with it its worthy consequence of extreme admiration. No one was considered so wise and far-seeing as Mr. Watson. Chapter 51. Meeting Again. Bear up, brave heart. We will be calm and strong. Sure we can master eyes or cheek or tongue, nor let the smallest tell-tale sign appear. She ever was and is and will be dear. Rhyming Play. It was a hot summer's evening. Edith came into Margaret's bedroom, the first time in her habit, the second ready-dressed for dinner. No one was there at first. The next time Edith found Dixon laying out Margaret's dress on the bed. But no Margaret. Edith remained to fidget about.
"Oh, Dixon, not those horrid blue flowers, to that dead gold coloured gown. What taste! Wait a minute, and I will bring you some pomegranate blossoms."
"It's not a dead gold colour, ma'am. It's a straw colour, and blue always goes with straw colour."
But Edith had brought the brilliant scarlet flowers before Dixon had got half through her remonstrance.
"Where is Miss Hale?" asked Edith, as soon as she had tried the effect of the garniture. "I can't think," she went on pettishly, "how my aunt allowed her to get into such rambling habits in Milton. I'm sure I'm always expecting to hear of her having met with something horrible among all those wretched places she pokes herself into. I should never dare to go down some of those streets without a servant. They're not fit for ladies."
Dixon was still huffed about her despised taste, so she replied rather shortly,
"It's no wonder, to my mind, when I hear ladies talk such a deal about being ladies, and when they're such fearful, delicate, dainty ladies, too. I say it's no wonder to me that there are no longer any saints on earth."
"Oh, Margaret, here you are. I have been so wanting you. But how your cheeks are flushed with the heat, poor child. But only think what that tiresome Henry has done. Really, he exceeds brother-in-law's limits. Just when my party was made up so beautifully, fitted in so precisely for Mr. Colthurst,
There has Henry come, with an apology, it is true, and making use of your name for an excuse, and asked me if he may bring that Mr. Thornton of Milton, your tenant, you know, who was in London about some law business. It will spoil my number quite.
I don't mind dinner. I don't want any, said Margaret in a low voice. Dixon can get me a cup of tea here, and I will be in the drawing-room by the time you come up. I shall really be glad to lie down.
No, no, that will never do. You do look wretchedly white, to be sure, but that is just the heat, and we can't do without you, possibly. Those flowers a little lower, Dixon. They look glorious flames, Margaret, in your black hair. You know we planned you to talk about Milton to Mr. Colthurst. Oh, to be sure, and this man comes from Milton. I believe it will be capital after all. Mr. Colthurst can pump him well on all the subjects in which he is interested, and it will be great fun to trace out your experiences, and this Mr. Thornton's wisdom, in Mr. Colthurst's next speech in the House. Really, I think it is a happy hit of Henry's. I asked him if he was a man one would be ashamed of, and he replied, "Not if you've any sense in you, my little sister." So I suppose he is able to sound his H's, which is not a common Darkshire accomplishment, eh, Margaret?
Mr. Lennox did not say why Mr. Thornton was come up to town. Was it law business connected with the property? Asked Margaret in a constrained voice.
Oh, he's failed, or something of the kind. That Henry told you of that day. You had such a headache. What was it? There, that's capital, Dixon. Miss Hale does us credit, does she not? I wish I was as tall as a queen and as brown as a gypsy, Margaret.
But what about Mr. Thornton?
Oh, I really have such a terrible head for law business. Henry will like nothing better than to tell you all about it. I know the impression he made upon me was that Mr. Thornton is very badly off, and a very respectable man, and that I'm to be very civil to him. And as I did not know how, I came to you to ask you to help me. And now come down with me, and rest on the sofa for a quarter of an hour.
The privileged brother-in-law came early, and Margaret, reddening as she spoke, began to ask him the question she wanted to hear answered about Mr. Thornton. He came up about this subletting the property, Marlborough Mills, and the house and premises adjoining, I mean. He is unable to keep it on, and there are deeds and leases to be looked over, and agreements to be drawn up. I hope Edith will receive him properly, but she was rather put out, as I could see, by the liberty I had taken in begging for an invitation for him. But I thought you would like to have some attention shown him, and one would be particularly scrupulous in paying every respect to a man who was going down in the world. He had dropped his voice to speak to Margaret, by whom he was sitting, but as he ended he sprang up and introduced Mr. Thornton, who had that moment entered, to Edith and Captain Lennox. Margaret looked with an anxious eye at Mr. Thornton while he was thus occupied. It was considerably more than a year since she had seen him, and events had occurred to change him much in that time. His fine figure yet bore him above the common height of men, and gave him a distinguished appearance, from the ease of motion which arose out of it and was natural to him. But his face looked older and careworn, yet a noble composure sate upon it, which impressed those who had just been hearing of his changed position with a sense of inherent dignity and manly strength. He was aware, from the first glance he had given round the room, that Margaret was there. He had seen her intent look of occupation as she listened to Mr. Henry Lennox, and he came up to her with the perfectly regulated manner of an old friend. With his first calm words, a vivid colour flashed into her cheeks, which never left them again during the evening. She did not seem to have much to say to him. She disappointed him by the quiet way in which she asked what seemed to him to be the merely necessary questions respecting her old acquaintances in Milton. But others came in, more intimate in the house than he, and he fell into the background, where he and Mr. Lennox talked together from time to time. "You think Miss Hale looking well," said Mr. Lennox, "don't you? Milton didn't agree with her, I imagine, for when she first came to London, I thought I had never seen anyone so much changed. Tonight she is looking radiant, but she is much stronger. Last autumn she was fatigued with a walk of a couple of miles.
On Friday evening we walked up to Hampstead and back, yet on Saturday she looked as well as she does now. We?
Who? They two alone. Mr. Colthurst was a very clever man and a rising Member of Parliament. He had a quick eye at discerning character and was struck by a remark which Mr. Thornton made at dinner time. He inquired from Edith who that gentleman was, and, rather to her surprise, she found from the tone of his